Welcome to Risk Revolution, a podcast series that examines all aspects of risk management in the life sciences industry. We'll talk to industry experts on best practices for identifying risk, assessing risk, measuring solutions, implementing solutions, and monitoring results. Here are your hosts, Nuala Callan, Valerie Mulholland, and Lori Richter.
Well, welcome back to Risk Revolution, our monthly series seeking to advance the maturity of risk management practices across the life science sector. As usual, we'll be covering topics that challenge professionals within the biopharmaceutical and medtech industries as we aim to shake up the paradigm to revolutionize the ways in which we perceive and proactively manage risk. Well, I'm excited because for this episode, we are delving under the hood and looking at some real-world implementation issues that can be found in industry today, with the practice of both risk management and change management. And to share his expert insights and experience, I'm delighted to welcome a good friend and colleague of mine, Paddy Costello, Senior Director at Lachman Consultant Services, with a wealth of knowledge gained over 25 years in the industry. But he's been on sides of the fence, starting out as a regulator, initially with the Health Products Regulatory Authority, HPRA, here in Ireland, and then on to foreign climes with the European Medicines Agency in various inspection and compliance roles. But in 2018, Paddy crossed over to the industry with AbbVie Inc. and led teams responsible for global quality event management and reporting on such items as quality defects, BMPDRs, FARs, MDRs, drug shortages, and then on to reporting around responsibility for management review, quality metrics, and even working with the team developing data analytics to inform their QA risk-based decision making. But in 2024, you joined Lachman Consulting Services, where you now bring your own unique perspective, ensuring the highest standards of product quality and regulatory compliance. And your expertise, as always, spans across global markets, where you routinely navigate the complex regulatory reporting frameworks, including those at EMA and FDA. So, Paddy, you really are our ideal guest to explore today's topic of the real world challenges that we're delving into. And for our regular listeners, hang in there because I'm running solo today as both of my pod co-hosts, Val and Lori, are kicking up their heels somewhere nice in the world on a night off. So, Paddy, let's start with this topic of change management as practice today. And in particular, let me ask you some questions that you posed in your two excellent blog posts that you wrote last year with your colleague, Andy Hopkins, entitled Change Management Enabler or Blocker. And don't worry, I'm going to post the links in the show notes, listeners, so you'll get your hands on those blog posts. But where do you land, Paddy, on this thorny issue? Enabler or a blocker?
First of all, thank you for the introduction. Great to be on. It's a very difficult question. I think it can be a great enabler for an organization, but I do think as an industry, we struggle quite a lot. Change is hard. Change is hard from a personal perspective. If you're changing job, you know, changing relationships, changing circumstances, it's difficult. And certainly even in our day-to-day interactions, we're running through these mental checklists of what's a pro and what's a con of this decision. So, you know, and that's totally impacted by our, appetite for risk. And, you know, that's the great human condition. Some people are very risk averse. Some people don't see the risks that others do see. So that translates quite well into large organizations. We, you know, and probably becomes more complex and more difficult to get change implemented and managed across a global organization. But we see a real focus from regulators on change management because they feel it's a prerequisite for any decent functioning quality system out there. And so they're placing a heavy focus on it. And certainly when I was an inspector, it was an area where I spent a lot of my time. And it's probably part of that history, which has kind of led to this blog that myself and Andy generated. And some change control has become so complex that it's not fit for purpose. It turns into a monster You may need to read an 80 or 90 page document to be able to raise a change in your system. And so if it becomes overly complex, people don't like to use it. They have shadow systems, but also then it's not responsive enough to effectively manage change and also the risk that comes from that change. And probably one of the areas where we see possibly inappropriate use of change management systems is the lack of change being refused within the system.
I often refer, like yourself, I've come across change management or change control SOPs that are 60 pages long. And it ends up being so complex that it acts like cholesterol in the arteries of the organization. It slows everything down. And like you say, then people have, the natural inclination is to call it anything but a change and to do a workaround and to find another way of avoiding having to go through this very painful monster of a process. But in your blogs, you gave some excellent examples on how change management systems, those complex change management systems, can actually act against an organization. Maybe you can share some of those examples that you gave.
Yeah, I mean, some of the times we've seen is like people will start using like for like changes, which aren't too similar. Maybe replacing a ceiling with another ceiling, but it's totally different. But it's a like for like change. So people begin to just play with the terminology or maybe some perceived flexibility that they see in that overly complex SOP.
And wasn't there another example, Paddy, around a decision to replace or not replace a firm's water system that was coming close to the end of life with some limited spare parts availability?
For sure. I mean, we certainly see that more and more. And FDA has talked about aging facilities, but I think even some of them have begun to talk about obsolete facilities. And if you're, a water system is a good example, but if you're buying parts for a machine that's no longer supported by a vendor and you're buying it on eBay or you're buying it from the web or you're trying to buy it secondhand from a maybe another peer organization, then you probably have gone beyond that lifespan of that piece of equipment, but that's not really actively managing what you should be doing in relation to that system. We would expect that that would be raised within the change control system, and if you're refusing to update it, how you're documenting that within the system. And that's certainly came out in other parts of the blog as well, and certainly as we discussed it more. We found we had many examples of pieces of equipment not being changed at the appropriate time.
And in fact, in that second blog post that we'll provide the link to as well, you really focused in on this issue where, financial resources or CapEx approvals for much needed critical facility or equipment upgrades are being denied. And yet that's not necessarily being recorded in the change control system or the change management system. It's not, and you asked that question, is your change control system simply a record of approvals only? Where do the ones go that get rejected?
Exactly. I mean, I think the vast majority, if you look at change control systems, they seem to have changes inputted that have been approved by the change review board. But usually prior to the change review board, there's a kind of CapEx committee that's deciding where we're going to invest our limited resources. So they essentially have the yes, no over a particular change. So we're seeing many change management systems simply have no refuse change in them, or very small amounts of refuse change, which isn't the normal expectation. The expectation is that you have those refusals in there, and on an understanding of the impact of that refusal and whether that's tripping over and causing higher risk for the patient or the product. And that's probably one of the frustrations that drove the blog. Was the lack of the refusals in the system, because if you refuse a change, it still has an impact. If you decide to delay a water system, that can have a direct impact on product quality and then have a direct impact on patient quality. It can just generate a lot of deviations within your deviation system if it's beginning to go out of control. Are you getting hits on environment on monitoring of the water system? So it's beginning to start generating a lot of noise in your quality system. And if you're not able to demonstrate as a quality organization that you've tried to raise this in a change control and raise it to senior leadership and say, hey, we'd like to get this approved, and that's not documented in the quality system, then you kind of run the risk of having an aging water system, but also your change control system not raising changes in a timely fashion to get pieces of kit changed. And that's certainly where you could get multiple hits within a finding for the one issue. You could get hit for having an aging piece of kit. You get hit then for the amount of deviations that are being generated. Maybe there's an ineffective CAPA in place, as well as poor maintenance approaches, and also then poor change management. So you could get almost three or four different hits for the same issue because your quality management system isn't managing that change appropriately.
Yeah, and in those cases, I routinely come across similar examples, and yet you can either find, the operations team or the maintenance or engineering team who are, saying, "Well, we've told you about this. It's not like you didn't know." But of course, if it's not documented that there was a refusal on the basis of, allocation of resources, as you say, we accept that we don't have a magic wand and a blank checkbook, but at the same time, we should at least record the fact that we're currently willing to accept that risk. Because there is no such thing as zero risk. But as the years go on, at which point do you say this is no longer an acceptable risk? And like you say, if you're scouting eBay for spare parts, that's probably telling you you've gone into the dead zone. But that brings us nicely on to the role of, the site risk register and senior management's responsibility for oversight, monitoring, and review of active risks on their given site. And in fact, I went to the trouble of looking up, what is the purpose of a risk register? And in fact, obviously, none of our GMPs state thou shalt have a risk register, but they do, set specific requirements. And the spirit of the regs and the guidance in industry does set the expectation for risk monitoring. It's very clear that we have a responsibility for oversight and monitoring of our risk. And even now with Q9R1, the integration of knowledge, into that risk-based decision to consolidate where we've accepted risks and what our mitigation pathways are intended to be and to document that rationale. And so that, decision makers and the stakeholders who make those decisions have access to, current knowledge and actionable demonstration of evidence that where they're happy to say, we're not replacing that system just yet. So it's funny, in my experience, site risk registers are notoriously difficult to get right. And 9 times out of 10, when I review them, I'm underwhelmed or left with the feeling that the leadership are either not aware of the risks or are not alert to the current vulnerabilities that they have in their business. So where are your thoughts, Paddy, on site risk registers? And also, while I'm at it, do you think they are actively reviewed enough, perhaps, by inspection teams during an inspection or an audit?
I would certainly, you made a couple of very really important points. I think, as society, we are accepting a risk. I think historically, and certainly regulators, I think have got a much better understanding of risk and are accepting that there's always going to be some risk, and that maybe some of the old mantras of no risk is acceptable has fallen away to some extent, and that's what's driven a lot of the requirements, and Q9 developments over the years. I think risk registries are a fantastic tool for an organization to defend approaches with that mindset of, accepting risk. All we're trying to see is, okay, if you've got a change you're trying to raise that has a potential impact on product quality or safety, and you're refusing that change, what are you putting in place to give you control? Is there other mitigations you can put in? What's your rationale for continuously accepting that risk? If we use that aging water system, okay, we're going to push out its change out from 25 years to 30 years, and that may be monetarily driven, But if you put in a good rationale, we're going to increase monitoring, we've got adequate spare parts, we've got support by the vendor, then your risk assessment looks an awful lot better for justifying that approach versus simply not documenting it at all. So I think that piece of the change management, and then as it links into risk registries, I would say that for any senior leadership team, they should know between the 5 to 10 top risks that impact the site. And then possibly another tier above that at a global system, they probably need to know the top 3 to 5 risks that each of their sites have. But I'd really question how many of those SLTs know that top 10 risks and how those risks evolve over time for their site. I think there's a great PICS document from 2021, which talks about how to evaluate and demonstrate the effectiveness of a PQMS in relation to risk-based change management. And I'm going to quote a couple of sentences from it, which is essentially what I've just summarized. The change management system ensures that changes are proposed in a timely manner, proposed changes are formally evaluated, and a decision to accept or reject. So they're not asking you to accept everyone. They're giving you the option to reject the proposal, but that it's documented. For rejected voided change proposals, particularly those that relate to mitigation of a quality, safety, efficacy, or compliance hazard, the system ensures that the rationale for those decisions are documented and well justified, and that continued risks are adequately managed. I think that's a really powerful couple of sentences, which talks about change and risk management, for an organization, but we're not really seeing that being embraced on a day-to-day basis. So for me, if I'm doing an audit or inspection now, I just one of the first things I go to the change management system and the risk register. Some organizations are concerned about you seeing their risk register. Maybe they see it as a bit of an internal audit type system where this is where we disclose are maybe areas of highest risk or poorest compliance internally, and we don't want to share that externally. But I think a good inspector could justify why they would go into a risk register to be able to assess compliance on site. And certainly the quality culture then comes through quite strong in relation to an organization.
Yeah. You know, one of the points, I love that document, by the way, and it's been, you know, used extensively. And I know one of our close friends and colleagues, Professor Kevin O'Donnell from HPRA, he routinely cites it. He was heavily involved in the drafting and the training of the PICS Inspector group on that. And it is a really, really valuable document. So for all the listeners, we'll link it in the show notes. But you know, it's interesting. One of the words that you mentioned there in your quote was around understanding where the hazards are. And you know, Q9 or one brought in that term of hazard identification as opposed to risk identification. And I think that this might be a hook that we could, you know, somehow try and move the needle on this. Because in some cases, when I look at risk registries, they're that, you know, they're giving the RPN score. Is it a high, medium, or low, or is it a 10, 8, or you know, whatever, 5, or whatever it is? And of course, we know that RPNs, and everyone who listens to this podcast knows that they're fake math. But you know, if they were actually listing the hazard and therefore the associated harm to the patient or the product quality or a compliance risk, if they boiled it back down to what is, rather than saying, well, we have a high risk with a water system, what is the hazard of that going out? It might be a single point of failure. We will bring, from a business perspective, we'll bring the whole plant down. You know, we won't be able to produce, we won't be able to clean. And from a harm perspective, if it doesn't bring the whole plant down, we could potentially have, you know, whatever that is, depending on what the water system is, we could have a patient safety risk out there as well with all the challenges there. So perhaps the problem is that a lot of the risk registries, you know, and the templates and the formats of that were built around that concept of risk identification, as opposed to now Q9 or one, which says it's all about identifying the hazards and the associated harms. And then risk management is about putting in a control to control those harms. And like three simple columns, you wouldn't need to put a score, you wouldn't need to have them high, medium, literally three simple columns to say what is the hazard, what is the potential harm to the business or the patient, and what, you know, what is the control that we're putting in place or the mitigation plan, or, you know. And the other thing that I find about risk registries is that they don't provide responsibility, the accountability of who is the risk owner. You know, sometimes I'm really struggling to say, so who owns this risk? You know, is it the process owner? Is it the product owner? Is it the system owner? Who actually owns the risk? Because now I can start to say, well, where's your enhanced monitoring and controls? So are you doing enhanced monitoring? Are you doing more environmental testing or whatever it might be? And therefore, who is responsible for doing that and at what frequency? And when do they raise the flag if they have a concern? But those risk registries very often completely miss the accountability piece. And therefore, it's like it's being passed up the food chain to these, you know, higher beings who are going to decide whether we're a go, no go. But we don't have that rationale. Now, I'll stop on my soapbox. Just in terms of your own thoughts then of, you know, how could we better document or improve the practices, the daily practices around risk registries and getting leadership to take their senior management to take that responsibility. And any thoughts of how we could improve that?
That's really difficult. I think we're probably at a very immature stage in how we manage hazards. I like the way thanks for correcting that. I think maybe we need to talk about hazard registries instead of risk registries, and get that terminology out there more. I like what you say about a number. I'm not a big fan of a numbering system, and certainly don't want to see detectability in any hazard registry.
Hallelujah.
That's more of a mitigation strategy. It doesn't take away the severity or the frequency of occurrence. And that's, I don't know how we've fallen into that. But we do see a lot of people bring that detectability piece in, and that according to them, that detectability takes down all their risk. So that's that, you know, certainly I think we're still quite embryonic in our thinking in that space. And I think it's going to take time for us to move that way. You know, a simple system like you mentioned would just, you know, the hazard defined, who how it impacts the patient, and then what mitigation is great. And in global organizations, you know, ownership has always been a struggle. I would certainly echo what you just said there. While you might have a particular SOP owner or a process owner, it's very hard for them to have the decision-making rights around capital expenditure that they may need to fix a particular hazard or design out a hazard. But I mean, they can put in the mitigations if there's, once again, that the mitigation can often have a cost associated with it to them as well. So I think that becomes very difficult, that ownership piece. And I haven't seen it done well.
Yeah, and I think it may come down to us seeing some citations associated with the lack of oversight by senior management. Obviously, they can't necessarily be called out. You don't have a risk registry, but you're not monitoring for where your critical risks are, and you're not demonstrating that you're using evidence and data to and science to support your decision rationales. So, you know, I know with my colleague Marty Lippa, when we talk about knowledge management, we also talk about decision logs as one of the knowledge management tools, which kind of goes alongside what you're saying there with the risk registry, so that we have that documented rationale for historic purposes, if for nothing else, to be able to because people change and roles change, and you know, risk acceptance or perception changes. But yet we, you know, often, you know, you walk onto a site and the first thing you'll hear is, well, that isolator or that autoclave that, you know, is steam powered at this stage, you know, 30 years old or whatever, is the single point of failure that could bring the house of cards tumbling down, irrespective of all the other bits and pieces. So, Patty, we're great believers here at Risk Revolution in the power of Gemba. You know, get out there, go see, observe, ask. We're definitely not believers in this, let's go to the PQS system or whatever that system might be, and pull up a data chart or a trend. They can be helpful, but your eyes and your ears can tell you a lot. Can you share some examples of where, real risks perhaps only became visible during practical observation of given facilities, processes, systems, and people? You can read all the SOPs and you can be hear all the management reviews and look at all this fancy PowerPoint decks you like, but suddenly you walk in and you get a feel for an organization and how they behave in terms of risk.
Yeah, I mean, and sometimes that feeling can come really quickly. Inspectors often talk about that kind of gut feeling about a site, and it can come quite quickly. And maybe, before we get into Gembas, it's that link to that culture piece can come across very quickly from your interactions on site. Just going back to the Gembas, like you mentioned, there's an old saying, familiarity breeds contempt. But from a quality operations perspective, I think familiarity can kind of breed a kind of snow blindness or a quality risk. Or quality hazard blindness, if we're using the terminology correctly, to the things that we see every day. The amount of times you go on site and an operator or a quality professional will simply say, well, this is the way we've always done it, or this is our process. Can be quite frustrating. A Gemba is a powerful tool if performed by the right people, and I don't want to overcomplicate that either. That doesn't mean you have to go out and bring in outside help. Often, simply having people naive to a particular area, asking some of the very basic questions that you asked, or a five whys type question, can illuminate areas that many of us have been blind to for years. So, yeah, I'm a firm believer in that. But once again, in the industry, we tend to overcomplicate it. It doesn't have to be that overcomplicated thing. It can just be, a number of people from different areas cross-checking each other. In terms of maybe some of the things that pop up quite quickly when you're doing a Gemba at a site, I guess one of my bugbears is, bulk drug substance filling. Seems to be a very manual process. And has been a very manual process for the last 25, 30 years. Now we're seeing automated closed systems out there, but we're seem to be very slow to take on that technology, and that technology can, decrease the risk substantially to the patient and the product. And we're really surprised it's not considered. It can give you an awful lot of greater flexibility in your facility. It can be easier for the staff to work with instead of being in a microbiological safety cabinet or in a grade A environment. That's always surprising when you do a walk and you see a kind of manual drug substance filling into bottles. And then, like what we mentioned at the start, just seeing aging facilities and obsolete facilities, very quickly they come across, even if they're clean and well kept. We're seeing RABs or isolators or water systems, some pieces of kit are 25 years old, or the return on investment has been made, yet we're really slow to move to newer technologies. And that's certainly isolators are getting a big hit from regulators now. If they're 25 years old and the indirect product contact parts can't be sterilized, there is a problem. If it's only VHP decontamination, the citations are many in the last 12 to 24 months. And PAIs are being refused by FDA. So you may have manufactured, monoclonals on this isolator line for the last 20 years. You want to bring another monoclonal into that line, and FDA are simply saying, no, you're not meeting the requirements as of now, or I guess that little C in cGMP. And I think maybe that's what we're as industry we're not seeing. This piece of equipment 25 years old. Inspectors and investigators have fantastic visibility as to what's available in the industry. So you're being inspected to GxP regulations and guidelines. So that whatever the laws are, but as I said, you're also being inspected to that little C that continuous improvement of those GMPs. So you're essentially being assessed against best practice, which is being driven by your peers. So if FDA have come from four brand new sites that have the latest technology and they come into your site, which has a 25-year-old isolator in comparison, you're probably going to get a lot stronger review of of that older piece of kit. And they're probably going to start issuing citations based on that. So in a gemba, that comes across very quickly when you see that. And that's another area that I think inspectors are spending more time on, is that your asset register. And maybe some of those aging assets flip onto your risk or hazard registry. And if you've got a piece of kit that's 25 years old, every year you're assessing it. Is this risk getting too, is there appetite for the risk associated with this piece of kit changing? And I think that's really important from a gamble perspective. You identify those very quickly. And the first thing I ask for is an asset register stratified by age, and they're the pieces I want to see on my Gemba.
Yeah, that's really interesting. An interesting way to look at it. And I think, that whole issue around going out there looking and seeing, I don't know how many senior managers or indeed above site managers, they may do the tour of the production suite. But like you say, with the snow blindness that you referred to, Diane Vaughan, who wrote the report on the space shuttle Challenger disaster, she referred to that as the normalization of deviance. That we be it's a boiling the frog. We become normalized to the fact that deviations or deviance is part of doing business, which it's not. And we can end up with that snow blindness, but. While you might see the tour coming through the main production suite, you don't see too many of them in the utilities areas, looking at the HVAC or looking at the water systems. And perhaps that's what they need to do is go and look at some of those, utility areas to really alert them to where, before they make that risk. And you make a good point there, Paddy. Very often, the 25-year-old isolator might be on the risk register, the site risk register, but it hasn't budged in terms of its action plan in 5 years. So, and yet we're 5 years older or 3 years older, and therefore, what are we doing differently than we were doing when it went onto the register, other than the fact that we're still rejecting the CapEx improvement in it, So,
Maybe
in my
capacity on
view,
it as
these
well.
things, these things need to move. The risk register should be a live document, and if you're continuing to hold that risk, then you've got to have some alternative strategies and enhanced strategies around what you're doing in the meantime, even if it is building a parallel process or something somewhere where we're going to continue to use this until the new process goes in or something. But tell me what you're doing in the meantime. But this all reflects on the culture. You've mentioned it, Paddy. It reflects on the impact of culture on a site, on both patient safety and product quality, from a risk management perspective. Have you any other thoughts around, how we can. I know there's been a lot of talk with QMM, quality management maturity, from FDA and even now from the EMA looking at pilot sites to start looking at PQS effectiveness. But how do we get those senior leadership or above site, to really address the culture on the site, not just assess it, but address it? I see a lot of assessment of culture, culture assessments. And I also see a lot of, pulse surveys and things like that. But I'm still kind of left, hoping when it comes to seeing them address the culture, actually take some implementation and action on it. What are your thoughts on that?
Wow, that's a big question. It's a very difficult question. I would say it's recently got more and more focus from regulators because I guess they've seen a lot of poor culture, to be honest. And the two topics we've just talked about, change management and hazard management, I think are two of the quickest ways to estimate a kind of a culture, the quality culture of an organization. And it can be difficult. Like you said, it's very hard to see who's got the ownership. And a good quality culture can often come across quite quickly in terms of that inspection or investigation. You can see how the individuals interact with each other, if there's open dialogue, if there's some level of psychological safety. That can often work well within a site, but then when it goes above site, that can be quite poor. So often they may try and manage a lot of this internally, and above site may not see it. So that's why we're really, I guess, pushing or hoping that these hazard registries and change management can be used in a fashion that can communicate the risk in hopefully in a culture that is open to receiving that information and addressing it or mitigating it as best they can. In turn, and the opposite tends to happen as well. We see with weak cultures, then there's a real underestimation of risk. It may not even get raised to senior leadership on site, and certainly doesn't go anywhere near the senior leadership team of a global organization. And that can be I guess that's the exact opposite of what I've just taught. That doesn't get documented anywhere, and that culture just really is, I would say. It's a concerning culture that you pick up quite quickly. I mean, I've seen it done well on seldomly. A lot of people are kind of in that middle part. They may have very good hazard registries, but the ownership and the mitigation is poor. And certainly, it tends to be managed a bit better on site. And a lot of it doesn't get communicated up. I'm not sure if I fully get the question there.
No, absolutely. I agree with you. And you can say poor quality culture or a healthy one, but it is down to the fact that sometimes the driver or people's perception of what the driver is to keep the volumes moving. And to some extent now with ICHQ 9R1 saying that we have equal accountability in terms of product quality and product availability, sometimes people are jumping on that product availability, which isn't necessarily a shortage situation. It's more about feeding the market and keeping the volumes at the right, meeting the schedule. But look, we're not talking about an industry that's that's a not for profit. These are for profit organizations, and of course they are, that's their purpose, and their commitment to the shareholder. But the commitment to the patient needs to come first, and that's for me where I see that, and where I see that connection to the patient when I'm walking the floor, and when people know who their patients are and they know what their products are for. That tells me a lot, like you say, in terms of how they're interacting and that psychological safety. But that's the gift we have in our industry, that our customers, our patients, we're not just selling Apple iPhones or lithium batteries or something that people can change allegiance fairly quickly. And making that connection for all of our people from the top to the bottom, and recognizing that we have that huge motivator by doing a good job, coming in every day to do to do a good job for the patients. That's where I see that working and being utilized and being being rewarded and recognized, when people are raising concerns or raising near misses and things like that. That's where you can see the culture is really good. But as you say, sometimes that doesn't filter up because it's not always the
No.
message that the above site leaders want to hear.
Often there's probably other systems that we can use. EH&S seem to have that hazard detection done a lot better than us, but we could use that for the quality aspect. It doesn't have to be a whole standalone system. So, there probably is things that we can mimic. I mean, as an industry, we're not slow fast to take on things. So there's other parts of and other industries that have had similar issues. And have and certainly have used other methodologies to be able to communicate risk appropriately. And I really like some of the EH&S systems I see where anybody can raise a hazard and get that documented within the system. And once you have the information, it's a piece of valuable information in terms of tracking and trending and what you intend to do with it. But at the moment, we're not as good at getting those hazards in to be assessed or tracked in front.
And that's really because we don't value them. We look on those kind of near misses in a quality context as a bullet that we've dodged, rather than a learning, a teachable moment where we can strengthen our controls. Well, listen, Paddy, you've left us with loads of food for thought on how to ensure that common sense and not complexity should rule in our daily practices for our quality and compliance practices, particularly around risk management and change management. So it's a big thank you to you, Paddy Costello, for joining me on the pod today. And as usual, we will be back next month with our usual range of topics, a mix of guest interviews. And actually, our next episode is our book club, our annual book club, where we'll share some of our favorite authors and books in the area of critical thinking, risk science, leadership, and human behavior as we search for learning on how we can strengthen our risk-based approaches to better assure product quality and availability. So please do subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, so new episodes will miraculously make their way into your feed. We have, as you know, set up a LinkedIn Risk Revolution podcast page, so please do join us there and feel free to message us with your thoughts or ideas. And finally, for the show notes for this month, we've got that PICS document that Paddy has referenced on effective change management, and also a link to the two brilliant blog posts that that Paddy and his colleague Andy Hopkins have written. So it's a goodbye from me, and we will see you next month. Thanks, Paddy.
Thank you.